Garner Ted Armstrong.
About peace all over the world. We have vast meetings between heads of state and government trying to achieve peace, to achieve disarmament, and yet not very much progress is made. Is such a world of absolute peace, of total disarmament, a utopian era of productivity, of an end to poverty and racial strife, an end to religious confusion, a total end to war possible? You know that secretly, most government leaders feel it is not. Deep down inside, most leaders today feel this world is headed for a World War III. Many people feel there's no need worrying, nothing's going to come out all right. Now, Americans had dreamed of peace through the year of 1966 and going around the corner of 1967 with everybody belting booze and getting plenty of Christmas spirit out of bottles. They were saying, Happy Holiday, Happy New Year. And has it ever sounded more hollow than this year? The press and television devote big space and time to the events of the past year. People are busy making analyses about their future actions and summarizing the past history of the world and talking about turning over a new leaf and beginning to live differently, and yet the world, about the time you've gone through another few weeks, is always the same, and it doesn't seem to really improve. And there's not very much peace and very much happiness. Well, a nationwide survey recently gave Americans a chance to tell what headline they would most like to read in the new year. And the American people have many ways of saying the same thing, but 9 out of every 10 people believe that the greatest single event would be a solution to the war in Vietnam and peace in the world. A representative sample of the nation's adults were asked, if you could look into tomorrow's paper and see any headline, what most would you like to see? And this is the way they said it. War ends in Vietnam. Troops return home from Vietnam. Or Vietnam dispute settled. Of course, many of them called for world peace in general. They said, peace comes to the world, or world disarmament a reality. Well, I have before me a newspaper. It is a newspaper that's a sort of a tabloid sample of what newspapers could be like if we knew the way to world peace. And here's an article on the front page of this newspaper underneath a picture of World War II tanks, which were being sold to farmers so they could plow up and pull up stumps and clear fields. And the headline of the article says, total disarmament achieved. Only piles of scrap metals and non-combustible war relics remain as disarmament program reaches final climax. This was hailed as the best news of the good news you've been hearing lately in this article, in this could-be newspaper. An announcement of the last vestige of destructive weaponry disappearing from the face of the earth. The article went like this. Thousands of workers cheered the ruling family as members attended the formal ceremonies marking the conversion of the last munitions factory in Irkutsk into an ultra-modern solar-powered automobile works. This brings to a completion the huge worldwide search for hidden arms, war relics, ancient souvenirs, and unexploded ammunition that had become such a part of the news of late. Another article about unlearning various mistruths and half-truths. Another article about a revolution in the weather for the better and how it was getting so monotonously good that people couldn't believe the good weather reports. Why shouldn't we be reading such news today? You know, most of us are so conditioned to bad news that to read very much good news would almost be boring. You listen to the news commentaries that you hear today and it's almost like an obituary. You read the newspaper, it's the same thing. I had to turn off a newscast the other day. I was listening, and here was a horrible train and tanker collision and people burning and roasted. Here was another horrible fire, and here were all the reports of 50-some dead in California alone and hundreds across the nation. And then the reports of all the violations of the ceasefire or the temporary Christmastime truce in Vietnam. And then all the stories about murders and a sniper on the freeway and people hurting and moaning and aching and paining in hospitals. And it sounded like a grisly sort of an obituary, and you get tired of listening to it. You know, you just can't tune on the radio and hear very much good news today. But what if you could hear of news like that? Total disarmament achieved. Now, we long for it, we wish for it, we hope for it, people pray for it, but we don't get very much of it. But there is going to come a peaceful world tomorrow. There is a master plan for world peace. There is a way to world peace, and believe it or not, there exists a completely documented, thoroughly approved master plan for world peace that will bring in a utopian era of real plenty. the solution to the biggest, most pressing problems of mankind, among which are, and in about this order, the population explosion, the threat of food wars, race wars, then the hydrogen and atomic bomb, the overkill of 44 times and then some, the deep, pressing political strife and problems of a world divided against itself, the problems of growing religious confusion and bigotry and prejudice, and then mounting crime and the dissolution of the home, the threat of the very building blocks of Western society, mounting divorce, rising juvenile delinquency, a preoccupation with crime and violence as a way of life, and a desire to escape on the part of people who simply can't face the wretched, hollow, clanging nothing that their lives have become, and who seek escape by belting booze, or like as not, mainlining H, as they say, in the narcotics staff of some police agencies. Yes, the solution to these problems can be achieved. But you know what world leaders expect? There are two very widely held and divergent views. And paradoxically, they point in totally opposite directions. Now, the one view of world leaders is that they really do think, although they might like to put it immediately out of their minds, that this world is going to be absolutely annihilated in a nuclear war. And eventually, and some of them think perhaps soon, you and I may be obliterated, and this Earth will be a cinder hulk orbiting endlessly in this galaxy of the Milky Way with no life but maybe some form of algae upon it. You and I have both seen the tongue-in-cheek cartoons, perhaps, of the two apes sitting on the one limb of a shattered tree deep in the Congo who look at each other dazedly as they behold the vastness of emptiness, of nothingness that is left on this Earth, and say, do you think it's worth starting all over again? Now, of course, that presents the evolutionary view, which ought to be investigated, which you can investigate by writing for a couple of booklets on that subject that I'll announce later. But you know that world leaders deep down inside their own minds are a little bit alarmed and fearful? Let me just give you a few quotations to prove that. You'll be amazed at what some of them have said and at how we have been told by government leaders to get conditioned to no solutions. Anyone, said one leader, who seeks to analyze and define this age in tangible terms is likely to experience a sense of bafflement. It's an age of contradictions, of challenging paradoxes. In a time when men are seeking to explore the stars, they're finding it increasingly difficult to solve the problems which affect them on this planet. And in a period when technology promises to usher in a new scientific utopia in which everyone will be happy, millions are gripped with a feeling of insecurity. President Johnson solemnly told a group of wounded Vietnam War veterans recently, it would be some time before there is peace. He said, I wish I could tell you that peace in the world is just around the corner. But he said, it will be some time and there are difficult days ahead. He spoke in a low voice. He told them how he wanted to let the American people know, we are in a time of trial, a time of testing, a time of uncertainty. Now, whether you people in South Africa or in Britain or in Australia or the rest of the world or Western Europe agree with American policies, this isn't my point. Whether you agree with the policies or not, you and I both agree that it's not right and not good that American boys or Filipino young men, and they're over there too, you know, or South Koreans or Australians or Britons are dying in the jungles of Vietnam, nor is it right that Viet Cong and North Vietnamese are dying or anybody else. It's not right, it's not good, it's not beneficial. Former President John F. Kennedy once said in a news conference, we happen to live in the most dangerous time in the history of the human race. We are destined, all of us here today, to live out most, if not all, of our lives in uncertainty and challenge and peril. And Mr. Kennedy also said in a speech before the United Nations back in 1961, mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind. Today, every inhabitant of this planet must contemplate the day when this planet may no longer be habitable. Together, we shall save our planet, or together, we shall perish in its flames. Now, in a more recent address to the nation and the world, President Johnson made these striking comments. This will be a disorderly planet for a long time. There will be turbulence and struggle, and even violence. The complexities of this world do not bow easily to pure and consistent answers. We often say, how impressive power is, he went on, but I do not find it impressive. The guns and bombs, the rockets and warships are all symbols of human failure. They are witness to human folly. We may well be living in the time foretold many years ago when it was said, and then Mr. Johnson dared to quote the Bible. It shocks many people to find that the Bible has any relation to today's world news, trends, and conditions, and to our very future. Mr. Johnson said, we may well be living in the time foretold many years ago when it was said, I call heaven and earth to record this day against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life that both you and your seed may live. You'll find that quotation back in the book of Deuteronomy, one of the beginning books of the Bible, in the 30th chapter. This generation of the world must choose, he said, destroy or build, kill or aid, hate or understand. What do you think we're choosing? What do you think mankind in general is choosing? What does your neighbor choose? What does the guy you get in front of or vice versa in traffic choose? What does somebody you bump into accidentally choose? What do the fans choose when they disagree with the referee's call in a basketball game? What do people choose in their form of entertainment or recreation? What do we choose in our attitude toward law enforcement, education, anything that smacks of stability, of permanence, of law, of ethics, mores, principles? What are we choosing as mankind in general? We're living in a time of unprecedented change. The United States has the dubious distinction of leading the world in several directions. Crime, divorce, and an endless assortment of modern glittering gadgets as temporary playthings that we cast aside. We're the biggest wasters on the face of the earth as well. The use of narcotics, well, maybe we can't hold a candle yet to China, but it seems we're trying. Now, in a time of such spectacular change, we're living in a sort of an empty, meaningless void in which people's emotions are confused, where crime is rife and running rampant, where divorce is striking at the very building blocks of our Western civilization, where our young people are fearful of the future, like the one young person who said, sure, I want to get to Europe this summer. Who knows whether Europe will be there next summer? Or like the young boy who, when he was asked what he wanted to be when he grew up, he said, alive. There are two widely divergent views of world leaders. One is that maybe the world won't even be here, and the other is that maybe we can create a magical world of science and industry, of push-button leisure and pleasure, and maybe somehow we can achieve a sort of a glittering Disneyland of endless fun and leisure time and enjoyment playing with an ever more complex assortment of mechanical gadgets and toys. Now, both of these views are investigated in a brand new booklet just hot off the press that answers for you these big questions of where do we go from here? What lies beyond? What is ahead? What do world leaders expect? And what is the world tomorrow all about? What is this program all about? What does it stand for? What does it believe? What does it preach and purport and promulgate? And this booklet entitled The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like, tells you exactly what you can expect. And inside of it is this tabloid-sized could-be newspaper, with some of these same headlines that people have said they would like to see. And this shows you what newspapers could be like if men knew the way to world peace. It's never before been offered on the air. This is the first time. It's absolutely free of charge. It's in full color, graphically illustrated all the way through, showing you conditions today, but showing you what science plans for the future, what government leaders suspect may occur. And it's 98 pages long, and all the way through it tells you exactly what will happen and the good news beyond. I'm going to begin a series now on this program of going through some of the very basic things covered in this booklet and showing you just what the world tomorrow will be like, not because of man, but in spite of what mankind does. Showing you what science says may occur, what government leaders claim may occur, and then showing you this great overall master plan for your future and mine. The predictions about the way the world will be, in spite of anything men do to the contrary. Now, what do you want to believe? Do you want to believe statements like, for instance, that one made by Mr. Seaborg, chairman of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission? He was sincere. To the best of his ability, looking at trends and conditions today, he tried to analyze what he could see in the future, and he said, we must stay strong, keep trying, and trust that freedom will win as it has in previous times in history when the future looks dark. But he said it would appear the best condition of the world we can hope for is a continuing crisis. He doesn't want to believe that any more than you or I do. But it's what people seem to believe today. Do we need to believe it, or is there some good news beyond? This book has shown you what that good news is. Now, on the one hand, many government leaders confess privately they're very deeply concerned about the future of mankind and the very survival of life on this earth. Then, paradoxically, science and technology dangle before our eyes a glittering glamour world of the three L's, leisure, luxury, and license. Plenty of leisure time, lots more gadgets and luxury, and plenty of license and permissiveness to do what we want to whom we get ready to do it, when we're good and ready. And they talk about unbelievable material devices and gadgets that are going to relieve us of all this horrible work, give us far more leisure, more pleasure, and more fun. But the amazing thing is, most of these glittering predictions seem to exclude the rest of the world and say, world, starve quietly, will you? Go to war quietly, will you please? Die without making too much of a fuss about it, will you? While 6% of the population of the earth continues to enjoy 50% of its wealth, and a tiny minority of us sit back on our haunches and play with an ever more bewildering assortment of pleasurable mechanical toys. You take a sane look at how this might develop and just analyze some of the statements made by people to predict this kind of a life. And here's what Mr. Herman Kahn, who was a physicist and director of the Hudson Institute, a big think factory located along the Hudson River that has nothing more to do with its time than a sort of a group of intelligentsia and people in a sort of a brain trust who are devoting their entire time to trying to predict and to map out the course of future generations and to try to come up with some workable way to peace. Dr. Kahn said, you can expect if you stick around till the 80s that this may be your life. 3-day weekends, 3 or 4 month vacations, Southern California type living with emphasis on family and at home, on income, on abundance of material things. But this won't come to all people, of course, emphasizes Dr. Kahn, because he says along with our barbecue society, we're in for a lot of beatniks. Revolutionary type movements and withdrawals from society. Now, let's just analyze it as we go along. Here you are in your Southern California-type split-level, sprawling, ranch-style home with your gorgeous swimming pool, and a revolutionary movement develops in front of your home. How would you like to have that as a prediction to come true? We're in for a lot of beatniks, and they're trying to climb over the wall to get into your backyard where your kids are playing. He says there are going to be problems in our barbecue society. Well, we've got a sort of a barbecue society going in Southern California, big megalopolis of today, haven't we? So snipers are running loose in the freeways. And the minute you cut the ribbon for a new section of it, a traffic jam ensues. Well, he said that it's going to be a little frightening when you take a real good look at it, because he talked about people living in 10-room houses with 3 cars in the garage. Can you imagine adding about another 30%? To the crowded traffic jams of the smog-infested, choking, gnarled, tangled asphalt, concrete, steel, and glass jungles we call cities today that are more like a botch on the surface of the earth? And further, he said, as for income, he felt between 5 and 10% of United States households may have a disposable income after taxes, and of course they're liable to go up, of between $40,000 and $50,000 a year. But he said, we'll live in 10-room houses, 3 cars, and a helicopter on the lawn. Does that kind of a society sound really good to you? Is it really practical? Can you imagine more and more automobiles, more and more private aircraft? Now, for instance, I have flown private aircraft myself, and I have come into some busy traffic control areas where you have to call when you're a pretty good distance out. You know, private business aircraft travel is increasing at an alarming rate. And air traffic controllers are pretty busy, especially in the United States. It's not quite so much, of course, in other countries. They're not keeping pace, perhaps, with the affluence. But air traffic controllers spend dizzying hours trying to untangle the massive travel of increasing jet travel in the big airports, where some private aircraft have had to simply be banned. And really, the busiest airports today are some of those that handle purely private aircraft. For instance, at one time back here a few months, unless it's changed, the Van Nuys Airport in Southern California was the busiest airport on the face of the earth, and they don't even have a single commercial airliner coming in or out of there. In Los Angeles, where they have two huge parallel runways. If the field gets socked in with fog down there, you can figure on 2 hours delay because they stack up the air traffic and holding patterns out there somewhere some odd miles to the east. And, of course, with two parallel runways, you can't have people making ILS approaches simultaneously, so they have the jet widely spaced to come in. Now, can you just take our growing problems, of which you read in such magazines as U.S. News and World Report, about growing noise around the airports, the problem of even finding space for an airport near a big city without taking about as much time to get from the airport to the downtown hotel as you did to get from the city on the west coast to the east coast, all the growing problems of collisions with birds, all the traffic jams you enter into, and the rest of it, put it all together and look at it practically and ask yourself, do you see helicopters on every yard, really? Can you imagine the hopeless snarls and tangles? Can you imagine a helicopter traffic jam with people maybe above throwing things at people below because they're mad? What about litter bugs in helicopters? They're tossing out lunch sacks and maybe monkey wrenches and you're below. Can you really imagine it stacked up 100 deep trying to deposit passengers atop a huge 50-story office building downtown? When you take some of these predictions and try to walk right on out into reality with them, you really get a problem. You think about the impracticability of it. I remember hearing in a speech here in Pasadena, before everybody who was practically anybody in Pasadena, California, the national head of the Chambers of Commerce in the United States talk about our 50-story high-rise apartment dwellings with our 25th-story shopping centers and our beautiful view of the ocean. If, he chuckled through the cigar smoke in the room, you will have a view of the ocean because of other 50-story high-rise apartments and the smog. Now, you know, human beings have to depend upon air and water and food, and we seem to be busily going about our program of polluting every last one of those three things today. Besmirching, befouling, and polluting our environment at a record rate, to where the smog problems of even such cities as formerly healthful Denver and Phoenix, where people were sent to get over their consumptive diseases, these cities now have smog. And it's in a frightening proportion, as a matter of fact. Some of the other proverbially difficult smog areas like London and Los Angeles and New York. So when you really write on these predictions and you look at it, you see what people are writing about a tiny segment of the population trying to enjoy more and more, you have to take it apart and begin to analyze it. Can you really begin to believe that that is going to be a really fantastic and a wonderful world in which to live, something that you want, something you hope to experience? Let me tell you what really would happen. This same man, in envisioning this future wonderful playland of ours, envisioned bigger and bigger crowds at bigger and bigger stadiums watching athletic contests. And, of course, some of these crowds smoking prodigious numbers of cigarettes and breathing the smoke-laden air can make you wonder whether they're going to cause it to rain inside the auditorium. We're getting them with roofs on today. And, you know, I think I actually heard that you can cause precipitation inside that Astrodome down there. Now, maybe not. You might have heard the one about the airplane in Texas that took off in heavy fog and wandered around till nearly ran out of fuel and tried to radio a tower to find out how to get down, then found out it hadn't left the hangar yet. They have big hangars, they claim, in Texas. Well, we're getting sports stadiums so big today that you wonder if it's going to rain inside. Now, can you imagine? I've been to a few of these athletic contests, and of course you wonder, well, let's get early and leave early. So people are leaving about 7 minutes before the end of game time because they want to beat the crush. Now, every year, of course, many cities sort of shudder under the onslaught of hundreds of thousands of visitors, primarily Southern California, and the granddaddy of all bowl games, the Rose Bowl, and the New Year's Rose Parade. But when you take a look at these predictions about more and more of everything, he said in 1985 we'll have increased crime. He said this would also occur, and that means that more and more people frequenting these same dance halls, bowling alleys, and golf courses will find their automobiles stolen or their persons attacked, or they'll be lying in pools of blood in more and more mass killings. And he said there'll be a lot more gambling and a lot more sexual promiscuity and more riots, along with more helicopters and more cars and a higher income. So you see, more and more people attending these bigger and bigger stadiums will find themselves in huge mob riots, which will kill bigger and bigger numbers of people as the frenzied tribes of humanity trample over one another trying to get to the exits.
And he says there'll be more and more air pollution, and that means higher and higher percentages of those same people who are living longer and longer will die from more and more respiratory illnesses and more water rationing, and more cities will mean fewer and fewer lawns for those larger and larger numbers of helicopters. So when you take the predictions and try to walk right on out into reality with them, they don't really sound quite so real. More and more, he concluded, there will be no place to hide. You know, sometimes when you look at the world, putting in the words of a member of the Los Angeles Police Force for 20 years and head of the narcotics division of it for 11 years, you take a look at the world outside and you want to go home and close your doors and pull down the blinds and lock the house and just kind of sit there with a machine gun. Now, not me. I don't want to sit there with a machine gun. That's what he said. But you look at the world and it's kind of frightening. Well, if you want to hear some good news for a change, keep listening to the series of programs I'm just now introducing. I'm going to go through it, show you what science and industry claim, show you what government leaders say, and then show you that there is a master plan for peace and give you the best news, the best series of headlines you have ever heard. But you can read it in advance and also this tabloid could-be newspaper by writing for this new booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow. That's the title of this program, just like for the World Tomorrow booklet. What it will be like. First time we've offered it. Brand new, 98 pages, full color, right off the press, absolutely free of charge and no price, no cost, no one's going to call on you. Send your name and address to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure to tell us the call letters at your station. The address again in just a moment. Until next time in the series, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.